Hello and welcome everyone. Thank you for joining Impax's Invest in Women Symposium. I'm your host, Kelly Baldoni. We're about to begin our second session of the day, which is focused on gender data. For anyone who has just joined today's events, a quick recap on logistical items before we move into the panel session. You will be in listen-only mode, but we encourage you to ask questions in the Q&A box anytime during the session. At the end, we'll do our best to get to the questions that come in. And if you have a question for a specific person on the panel, please note that in your question. If you have any technical issues, please drop us a note in the chat box and someone from Impax will assist you right away. It is now my pleasure to introduce my colleague, David Lowing, Vice President of Sustainable Investing at Impax, who is going to be the moderator for this session. So David, over to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Kelly. Really looking forward to today's session. But before we get started, I'd like to just have a quick level set. Better and more robust decision-making, oversight, and management are hallmarks of diverse groups. But increasingly, literature shows that companies with more women in their leadership ranks are more innovative, they have better human resource management with higher employee satisfaction and productivity, and better sustainability performance. Conversely, companies that don't proactively embrace diversity and equality, or whose cultures enable or ignore discrimination and harassment, are putting themselves at a clear disadvantage. They will not be able to attract and retain the best workforce, employee productivity and morale can suffer, and reputational and legal risks may arise. So what are the indicators that help investors identify where diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts are really working? Today, we're going to discuss what data are already available, what data we still need. We'll also discuss the sustained focus on race and ethnicity in the US, intersectionality across multiple dimensions of diversity, and the progress we've seen over the past few years. But before we jump in, I'd like each panelist to give a brief introduction of themselves and their organizations. So first, why don't I turn it over to Quaylen? Quaylen?
Hello. Thank you, David. I'm Quaylen Ellengrood. I'm a senior partner at McKinsey, and I lead a lot of our more globally focused gender equality and racial equity work. Great to be with you today.
Great. Thanks so much. And Deanna, how about you?
Thank you, David. Wonderful to be here. My name is Deanna van Maasdijk. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Equileap. Equileap is a company that researches over 4,000 companies around the world on gender equality. And we research them from their composition of their board to their pay gap, to their parental leave policies, anti-sexual harassment policies, and much more.
Excellent. Excellent. And lastly, Heather Smith.
Hi, thanks, David. My name is Heather, and I'm the lead sustainability analyst at Impax Asset Management. And one of my primary areas of focus at Impax is on equality, diversity, and inclusion. I'm part of the Impax Gender Analytics team that built the first global index of companies that are leaders in advancing women. I follow the research and trends around ED&I, and I also lead our engagement efforts in these areas.
Well, thank you to the three of you for being on the panel today. One of the first questions that I thought we could dig into is the status of company disclosure. What indicators are investors using the most and how are they using them? And I thought perhaps for some US market perspective, I'd turn it over to Quaylen first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David, I think in the US, I think we're lagging a bit. You see many companies sharing data across kind of diversity of the C-suite, so senior leadership teams, often because they feel compelled to, right? As peers and competitors share that, they feel the competitive pressure to do the same. But beyond that, I don't see a lot of consistent disclosure of that data. We're now at the point where every company has a lot of great data internally, both on gender and at least in the US by race. I think that's quite different in Europe where you might have maybe more data by gender, but not really by race. But in the US, I think it's still kept very much internally. You might set aspirations internally and share that with employees, but it's really more the exception that would proactively proactively seek out to disclose their own data at this point externally. There are a couple of notable exceptions, right? Companies that have for years literally published a report on their state of diversity, equity, and inclusion on an annual basis. But that is very much the exception at this point.
That's an interesting point about the race and ethnicity component to that. Deanna, from your perspective, what's the status of disclosure outside the US? I know that you folks at Equileap have a real global perspective. I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are.
Yeah, sure. I completely agree with Kuei-Lin. We cover 23 countries, and what we're seeing is that just like in the United States, most companies around the world are quite transparent when it comes to the gender composition of their board and their C-suite. Also, because many of them have to, by law, they have to be, they have to talk about the gender composition. I don't see much information on ethnicity, that's for sure. I think we're seeing that mostly in the United States. But what we are seeing is that particularly in Europe, there has been legislation to force transparency. So for example, overall, 85% of the companies that we cover around the world don't talk about their gender pay gap. Only 5% of the companies in the United States publish the gender pay gap. But in countries where there is legislation forcing them to do so, there's much higher. So in Spain, 82% of the companies publish their gender pay gap. In the UK, more than 70% do so. There's new laws in France since last year, not forcing this, but promoting this, where we see that close to 40, 50% are publishing. So it really depends on the legislation of a country. What we can say is that freely the companies are not publishing that much. When there's legislation forcing them, then they do it. But we are seeing that pressure from investors through engagement and stewardship is pushing companies to be more transparent. And the areas where we see that is, for example, do they have a policy to supply from women-owned companies? Do they have an anti-sexual harassment policy? These are kind of areas where we are seeing the pressure from the investors for them to publish.
And Heather, I know you do a lot of work as part of the gender analytics team. Are there certain sectors or particular companies that you feel are showing leadership or perhaps other highlights that you'd like to share?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, very broadly, I completely agree with, you know, what Kuei-Lin and Deanna just outlined. And those findings are very similar to what we see as we assess companies globally for our index. In terms of sectors, I think what's interesting is that we found that consumer-facing companies, so consumer discretionary or consumer staples companies, actually disclosed a little bit more diversity information than other sectors, and they certainly seem to be more responsive to investor engagement. I think that was because the perceived reputational risks for those companies were higher, but what we've seen recently is that that is really eroding and other sectors are starting to catch up. I think an example of that would be financials and information technology, which, you know, we know both of those sectors have a very long history of struggling to attract, retain, and develop diverse talent. But both sectors have seen companies vastly improving their disclosure in recent years and have started to lead the way on some of these topics that are less well covered, like pay equity. And again, I think part of this is driven by investor interest. It's driven by pressure to keep pace with their peers. But also by employee demands and companies recognizing that enhanced reporting can actually be advantageous in the competition for talent. I think, you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, disclosure still tends to be poor in other male-dominated industries like energy, industrials, and materials.
That's a good point. And I think a good segue to the next thing that I wanted to talk about were some of the trends that we've seen in reporting. I think we have a good snapshot about what things look like now, but what are the trends that you folks have seen over the past few years? Are there positives? Are there certain areas that are of concern? I know one of the things that we think about a lot at Impacts is the intersection of, among different dimensions of diversity. And we've made it 5 minutes into our discussion here, and somebody's already posted a question to the Q&A about that idea of intersectionality. Heather, Kuei-Lin, I wonder if either one of you, any observations about that intersectionality component, or just more broadly, some of the developments, either positive or of concern over the past few years?
Sure. I'm happy to start and then pass it over to Quaylen. You know, I think in terms of big picture, again, the norm is starting to shift towards more disclosure and not less. And I think that has started to take shape pre-COVID, but the primary focus of company disclosure was certainly around gender diversity indicators. But we saw the pandemic and increased calls for social justice following the murder of George Floyd in the US in 2020 really start to accelerate that trend and usher in, you know, a renewed focus around other dimensions of diversity, such as racial and ethnic diversity. I think that these events have propelled companies to publicly commit to change, you know, more so in the last decade that I've been doing this work with you, David. And, you know, while it's important not to conflate commitments with action, certainly, I think increasing demands for accountability, not just from investors, but again, from a broad base of stakeholders, so employees, consumers, and the entire marketplace, has really put companies on notice that making, you know, sweeping pronouncements about race, about gender, about their ED&I efforts, you know, it's not enough. And there does need to be some clear data and action, you know, backing those statements. I think, you know, part of the challenge that we've seen is that in the past, companies were reluctant to publish employee demographics or pay equity numbers that were quote unquote bad. But I think we have an acknowledgement that diverse representation is not where we want it to be. It's not where it should be. And instead, companies are recognizing the benefits of proactive disclosure around their efforts and performance and the value that it brings, not just to current employees, but to emerging talent as well. I think, you know, that's also a recognition that, again, greater transparency, particularly when it's honest and open about challenges, really gives more authenticity to a company's efforts. And I think it's generally well received as a starting point for moving forward. And then I think, you know, again, prior to the last 18 months, a lot of this focus of this conversation was on women, and that often meant white women. But it is becoming increasingly important for companies to analyze and collect data with an eye towards that intersectionality piece. You know, we know that the experiences of white women are very different from women of color in the workplace. And that's something that companies should be starting to address and be, you know, proactive about. And I know that McKinsey has done a lot of work on that, Quaylen. So maybe that's a good segue over to you.
Yeah, absolutely, Heather. We've been partnering over the last 7, now going on 8 years with leanin.org. And we've launched Women in the Workplace, which is the broadest and deepest benchmarking. This year, it was over 420 different companies. And exactly to this question and point, it looks at both by gender and race, that intersectionality question of what does the pipeline look like? Where are the pinch points? Where are there tougher pinch points for women of color than women overall? What we've seen in the talent pipeline, both cross-industry, and then I'll talk about asset management in particular, is that it starts off at almost 50%, right? 48% of the entry level. But keep in mind that college graduates, college degrees these days in the US and frankly in most developed countries, 56% of them are going to women. So if, you know, whether it's impacts or others are kind of getting their fair share of college educated talent, that 48% at the entry level that is women today would be closer to the 56%. But then it drops down pretty steadily, dramatically, kind of at that first step, at that first promotion to manager, all the way down to 21% of the C-suite is women. So 1 out of 5 people reporting to a CEO across the Fortune 1000 or so is a woman. But only 3% of them are women of color, which in our data is Black, Latina, and Asian women all added together. 3%, 1 out of 35 people reporting to the CEO are either a Black, Latina, or Asian woman, all added together. And in fact, it's worse in asset management and institutional investors. It's 2% of that C-suite are women of color. It's a little bit better at the board level, but frankly, not much. And that drop off for women of color, exactly to the question that was raised, is unique for women of color. There is drop off for men of color, but it's a lot less dramatic. And actually, you know, the share across women for white women, of course, increases a bit. So, you know, it's about 18% of the C-suite is white woman and just 3% women of color.
Those statistics are really concerning. I'm also wondering about the COVID implications. Quaylen, I know that the report that you were certainly instrumental in putting together touched on some of the COVID implications, but I guess a question for you and Deanna both, have there been any disruptions to some of the progress that we've seen because of COVID, or have things been progressing as they were before? I'm just kind of curious to hear what your observations are about COVID and how it's affected this journey towards equality.
Yeah, I'm still digesting the numbers of women of color. It's terrible. We're running a pilot on gender and ethnic diversity of the S&P 100 and hope to have that information by next year. So keep an eye out on that. But going back to COVID, yes, we know that COVID has had terrible implications on women in the workforce. What has happened, the data we've collected this year, we've closed the data and our report will be ready in March of next year. And we're expecting to see some major differences. But I was speaking to my research team today and they were telling me that already for the policies of flexible work, they are seeing increases. So for example, last year, only 19% of the companies had a policy to allow people to have flexible work locations and flexible working hours. And what the researchers have seen this year is that a lot more companies are making commitments for flexible work. Now, they can't do it otherwise. They have to. They have to because it's the only way to keep their workforce in times of COVID. So I expect that we will see an increase in the possibility of having flexible work. But that doesn't tell us what's happening to women at the home, right? And we know that there's also been a lot of issues around violence in the home, around inability to manage the childcare or older person's care and the work, and so leaving your work. And so I think that the real numbers will show now after 2 years of doing this research and being able to see it. But I don't expect to see much positive effects apart from maybe more flexible working possibilities for companies.
Yeah, I think gender equality and closing these gaps has always been a very long road, right? And it's often, you know, we talk in decades and every year, you know, the pipeline moves, but it moves between 0 and 1%, right, at every level. This is very long, slow progress that we're making. And often it's two steps forward, one step back. I think in the case of COVID, it is two steps backwards, and I hope one step forward through some of the flexible work and kind of greater ability to choose, but I'm concerned. And I'm concerned on a couple of levels. We also have been researching kind of flexible work. I think across the board, women and men in the US want more flexible work, right? They don't want to work in the office 5 days a week. When we asked specifically in the Women in the Workplace research, how many days a week do you want to be in the office versus at home? We saw a few different trends that remained remarkably consistent. Number one, women more than men wanted to have more days a week at home versus in the office. Parents, mothers and fathers, more than non-parents wanted to have more flexibility and more time at home. And more junior colleagues wanted to have more time at home than more senior colleagues. And that's what we've started to see as, you know, companies start to get back into that workplace. More of the senior leadership team is kind of in person more frequently often than many others. So that's on hybrid work, but there's also a bit of the burnout element. And we asked women and men, right, how do you feel either often or almost always burned out from your job at work? And last year, right, early days of COVID, a few months in, it was around 30% of women, 32% of women felt either almost always or always burned out. Something in the 20s for men. So men were also feeling burnout. That has increased dramatically. So now it's 42% of women are almost always or always feeling burned out. It's increased for men as well, but not as much. So it was uneven to begin with. More women than men have felt an increased sort of 10 percentage point jump in that burnout. And so that's a real challenge. And then finally, I would say around job losses. The US significantly has had, you know, many dual career couples. In fact, 80% of women are in the workforce, are in a dual career couple compared to more in the mid-50s for men. And I'm concerned that COVID has dramatically shifted those patterns. We have many fewer dual career couples as family units try to juggle, you know, remote schooling and a lot of other things, elderly care, as Deanna was describing. And that's been a challenge. So for example, in September, right back when schools were reopening in a hybrid way, 1.1 million people in the US either were fired or left the workforce. And a workforce that is almost 50-50, 80% of them in September were women, because mothers, by and large, were staying home to help their one, two, in my case, three children navigate remote and hybrid schooling. And so the impact on women's jobs, both proactively stepping out if somebody needs to, or the types of jobs that they have, I think has been disproportionate. We also know that women tend to have two-thirds or so of many of the industry jobs that have been significantly impacted by COVID, and where we're seeing a lot of accelerated automation. So customer service and sales, two-thirds women generally. Accommodation and food service, hotels, restaurants, all of these things where spending has dramatically cut back and a lot of closures are happening, two-thirds or so women. And so that's going to be a real impact on women's jobs. And I fear that that will hold them back from future, you know, income growth, job growth, career paths over time.
Yeah, that I found the reports that you co-authored to be incredibly helpful. And one of the other areas that I noted was the role of women in promoting ED&I at their organizations versus the men at their companies. And I share your concerns. It makes me think of the next area of questions, and because it really speaks to how do we get insight into culture, and do we have the right data for it to be useful, and do we have enough of it, and how does that data give us insight about a company culture, either to help make progress or to show that that progress and accountability is there. And in some of the prep calls that we had for today's panel, one of the topics that came up was the idea of family leave, among others. And I'm wondering, any of you, perhaps Quaylen, to start, what are some of those indicators that you think could be helpful for looking into a company's culture?
Absolutely. I think the biggest gap is we have a few metrics on diversity, but to your point, not nearly enough, and to our conversation earlier, not broadly enough shared. We have almost nothing on inclusion. And what data we do have on inclusion, like truly getting the value from the diversity that we have, is not publicly shared. It's not shared across companies. It's not even shared very publicly internally in many cases. And so I think broadening the level, the depth, and the breadth of diversity data so that we know not just at the senior leadership team and the C-suite and the board, as Deanna was describing, but across the organization, what is gender and racial diversity look like? We need to be much more consistent about that. And then as we shift to truly getting the value from inclusion, letting people bring their full and authentic selves to work, how are we doing on inclusion? I think balancing the diversity and inclusion data, I think, would be a huge step forward. And to your point on family leave, you know, the US, as you look globally, and Deanna will have sort of this global view, we are one of the very few developed countries that don't have a bolder sort of minimum standard family leave policy. And it was in the president's package. It was taken out at the last minute. But that is, I think, one of the big unlocks for more women to get into the workforce, for more women and men to stay in the workforce, to address a lot of the labor shortages that we have. Right now, we have a lot of people who have permanently left the workforce because either they have a skills mismatch or they're concerned for their own health and safety. And to alleviate a lot of our labor challenges, I think we need to address a lot of the things that are keeping workers, mothers and fathers, back. But one of those big things is family leave. Mm.
So I love talking about these things. And I agree with you that mix of diversity as well as inclusion related indicators is really helpful. And as investors, I wonder, like, what is the best way for us to make progress there? And Deanna, I'm wondering if you could talk with us a little bit about what is that role of investors in getting data from companies? What can they do?
Sure. You know, I absolutely agree that the lack of corporate transparency is one of the most persisting challenges of gender equality. But investors can play a crucial role. There is something that investors can do here. Engagement and proxy voting are very effective tools to get companies to publish diversity data. When you are an owner of a company and you have that power to go to the company and to say, listen, I need you to start showing these numbers. And previously you asked, what are the important data to show? Yes, we need to know about the policies, the practices, and the commitments of companies, but we actually need to know mostly the numbers. So what is the, what are the percentages of women and men at the workforce level, at the middle management level, at the senior management level, at the C-suite, and at the board? At every single one of these levels, we need to find out what is going on. Because if those, if companies or some companies tell us we do have a policy for gender diversity, we have great parental leave policies, and then we look and we see that their C-suite is 17% women, that their senior management is 20% women, that their middle management is 20% women, and their workforce is 50%. And we know that there's a problem, that even though they have the policies, they are not really putting them into place. There is not a culture to allow for gender balance at all these levels. So proxy voting, engagement are crucial, and every single investor can do that if you have the data. This is why we collect the data, and this is why we make this data available to investors so that they can go out there and have these conversations with the companies. And then the other way is to create portfolios where you are investing in those companies that have the best gender equality. And not only is that interesting for gender equality in the society, but what we have seen by backtesting our data is that those portfolios do better financially than the ones that don't, like you started talking about that, David. So there's two reasons to do this, both because it's good for society and it's good for your wallet as an investor.
Yeah, I think it's...
Go ahead, Heather.
I was just going to say, I think, you know, I totally agree. And engagement has been, you know, a crucial tool for us at Impacts and in driving some change at companies. And I think for us, it's about having enough data to be able to look at trends, right? So we can look at a company's board, we can look at it discloses demographics on the workforce. We can look at that to get a sense of what that company looks like today. But what we really want to know is, you know, where it's going and what it might look like in the future. And so I think that's where additional metrics around things like new hires, internal rates of promotion, retention, and attrition across gender, race, and ethnicity is important. And unfortunately, none of that is data that's required, you know, anywhere to my knowledge, but it would illuminate for us, you know, how companies are progressing. Because, you know, as Quaylen noted, we know to date that top line numbers move very slowly, but if we could get a trajectory of what the talent pipeline is looking like, I think that would be extraordinarily helpful as we work to craft portfolios that incorporate this data.
That's a great point, Heather. I guess I have two follow-up questions related to that. One, what data would we like to see consistently from one company to the next? And the second question, and related to that, do we need standardization of how that's reported? But also, I know talking with Heather and others about shareholder support for these issues, we're starting to see more shareholder proposals asking for this diversity data. So maybe I'll ask that question first. Heather, what kind of support or what are the trends that we see out there in terms of shareholders asking for this type of information? What kind of support is it seeing? And then we'll turn to the larger group to talk about what indicators do we want to see and do we need standardization?
Sure. Well, we're certainly beginning to gear up for the 2022 proxy season. And I expect that many of the themes that emerged prominently last year will dominate, you know, this season as well. The past season was unprecedented for a number of reasons, as issues of, you know, human capital and social justice coming into sharper focus for many. So as a result, we saw equality, diversity, and inclusion being a major theme during the proxy season, with shareholder proposals, you know, addressing a variety of topics and requesting reporting around the composition of companies' workforces, as we've talked about. What does their C-suite look like? Board diversity, better disclosure of board diversity policies. What are companies doing around pay equity and pay gap reporting? How are they addressing issues related to sexual harassment and racial justice? And what we saw last year was that actually a record number of diversity-related proposals received majority support at company annual meetings last season. And we have a very recent example. The Microsoft meeting just occurred at the end of last month, and shareholders there sent a resounding message to the company at their meeting when 78% supported a request that the company conduct an independent review of workplace sexual harassment policies. 78%, that is a huge number. And that's not something that we typically see when it comes to shareholder proposals that are opposed by management. There was also a proposal around pay gap reporting seeking enhanced disclosure that received 40% support, also very high. And following the meeting, the company indicated that it would in fact work to provide the requested disclosure on both of those issues. We also saw a new proposal last year that sought racial equity audits. So essentially a third party analysis of a company's impact on non-white stakeholders and communities. That proposal was filed at major financial institutions as well as some healthcare companies. And most of those proposals saw some strong support of about 30%. Usually it takes a few years for new proposals to garner that level of support, but again, first-time proposals on social issues were receiving votes of upwards of 30 to 40%. So, you know, I think that these are all very clear signs that these issues have investor attention and they are intending to hold companies accountable where they're not taking action that is sufficient.
That's incredibly helpful info, Heather. I agree. The levels of support that we're seeing are truly remarkable for, particularly for first-year proposals. For that question about standardization, Deanna, maybe I'll turn to you first and to Quaylen as well. You see a lot of data because you're researching so many companies at Equileap. Do you think we need standardization? And if so, what are some examples of things that you think would be helpful?
Yeah, definitely. I think we do need some standardization because it's difficult to compare when you have apples and pears. The areas where we would most like to see it is in pay gap reporting. Mm-hmm. I think it would be great if companies would all at the same way, in the same standard way, would report their mean unadjusted pay gap. That's the one that tells you the most, let's say. If we could get at least everybody to report on mean unadjusted pay gap. But you see that some of them do median, some of them do it adjusted, some of them actually report equal pay for equal work, but they call it the pay gap, which it's not. So that's one area where it would be really great to have the mean unadjusted pay gap. And then I would like to see those four levels that I mentioned. If every company would publish their gender composition and their ethnic composition would be great at the workforce level, the middle management, the senior management, the C-suite, and the board. If we could get those four levels to everybody to agree on that, and we would really take some huge steps forward. And then, of course, there's tons of other things I would like to see, like more anti-sexual harassment policies. And but I think that if we stick to the pay gap and to the numbers, we could make some great strides.
Why? Had one, I realize that we have just a few minutes left before we move to the Q&A section, but my last question is about progress. What are we seeing progress? So advancement of women into those senior leadership roles, greater pay equity. I guess the underlying question related to what you were just saying, Deanna, are we finding that those mandatory disclosures have really helped move the needle? Are they working or is there's still a lot to be done? So maybe I'll start with you, Deanna. I know pay equity is an area of mandatory disclosure. You were saying earlier, required in the UK. Do you think that is helping?
It is really helping. And I have another example, which is Australia. So Australia, about 12 years ago, had terrible reporting on gender equality. Just the companies were not doing anything. And then the Australian government put forward mandatory reporting. So not even targets, but just you had to report. And what we've seen today is that the Australian companies are started reporting and then started improving, because the moment you improve, you report, you get embarrassed about your numbers and how it's going. And so that mandatory reporting is improving. Today, Australian companies, when it comes to gender equality, even the mining sector, are doing much better than many other companies around the world. And it's because for 12 years, they were pressured by the government to report, just to give the numbers. So I see the same thing with the pay gap in Spain. in Italy, and then in countries where you don't have that, you don't, but also mandatory quotas for the board. So countries like France that years ago put into law that the board of directors had to be 40% female. Today we have 44% of the French companies have female board directors, but they had very poor numbers for the C-suite. So what the French have done a couple of months ago is they've put a new law for the C-suite. So they said, we waited long enough. And since the companies were not doing it by themselves, they've had to put law. So I think that that's one of the ways to go about it. But I also believe in the power of the investors. I think that investors can move. Companies do care about the investors. And if investors stand up and talk about these issues, change will happen quicker.
Agreed.
I think we've seen a bit of improvement more at the senior levels. So at that C-suite level, if you look back 6-7 years, at least in the US, we've seen those numbers improve by about 20% off their baseline. And that's where one different hiring decision, I'm gonna hire this woman instead of this man, you know, 10% up this way, 10% down that way. That's a 20 percentage point swing on one leadership team because of one different decision. And so that is, you know, the law of small numbers, where a couple of different decisions can move the numbers significantly. So at the C-suite level, at the board level, we have seen some improvement. SVP and C-suite level more in the kind of almost 20 or so percent range. But at the entry level, at the first manager level, at that VP level, where frankly the bulk of the women and people of color are, that's where we've seen 0-1% improvement every year. I think over the course of 5-6 years, around 5-ish or so percent at that front end of the funnel, sometimes even less. So very, very slow progress for the bulk of women and people of color.
So great perspectives on not just the mandatory disclosure, but the movement that comes from that disclosure, that accountability that it creates. One of the things that we sometimes hear questions about is the difference between pay gap and pay equity. Heather, I was wondering if you could just briefly maybe clarify for folks what are those two terms? What do they refer to?
Sure. So pay gap, which is what we typically see reported under the mandatory disclosure in the UK, is really it's an unadjusted or a raw gender pay gap. So it essentially means that a company is reporting on the difference between male and female earnings on average, but regardless of job function or level. So the raw gap exists because, as we just heard, you know, women are underrepresented in senior levels of companies and in the highest paying positions. The UK disclosure doesn't currently require information to be reported by race and ethnicity, but it's something that's being considered, and it is something that we've seen companies begin to voluntarily provide. On the other hand, pay equity, which is what we have seen companies tend to report in the US, means that companies are conducting a statistical analysis, often with the help of a third party, that incorporates attributes such as job category and role, region or market, experience, tenure, education, performance, and other drivers of pay to account for legitimate pay differences. When you look at the number that way, the gap shrinks substantially, but typically a small unexplained gap does remain. It could be as a result of discrimination. It could be the result of other decisions the company is making around performance reviews, promotions, et cetera. So it is important for companies to consider both metrics, which is why I was excited to hear Diana say we should see that reporting from companies on both of those items. But I think it's important to bear in mind that, you know, it's not necessarily only about the headline number, it's what's driving that number and really unpacking that and working to understand what are the other areas that we need to focus our efforts on. Where is equality of opportunity not happening? What are career paths for women and people of color? And so that's the work that companies need to do under that pay gap reporting. And that's where we have the really interesting conversations with companies about this issue, because it's certainly not pay equity or pay gap in a silo. It's really interrelated to all of the other issues that we were talking about today.
I realize we have to turn it over to Kelly for Q&A shortly, but one of the last questions I had for Heather about that, who's the audience for this? Because as Deanna has pointed out to me in the past, it's the law to pay people equally. So who's the audience for that type of information, and why is it important to disclose the results of that pay audit?
I think it's really important for employees and for potential future employees. You know, people want to know their company is paying attention to this issue, that they're having these conversations and that they're monitoring, you know, this information. I think one of the early conversations that you and I had with a company around pay equity, you know, the company said, well, of course we pay our employees equitably. And we asked, you know, did they communicate that to their workforce? Did they talk about that, you know, with their staff? And they said, well, no, we can't do that. And so there was a very large disconnect there. You know, if the company's doing something and not discussing it, then employees don't know. And so I think the benefit of what we've seen over the last few years around pay equity, around pay gap, is that we're having these conversations, we're raising awareness, and companies are starting to take action, albeit slowly and not as quickly as I think all of the three of us would like.
Well, thank you all so much for being part of this panel discussion. I've really enjoyed it. I always learn so much when I'm part of these conversations. Well, Kelly, I'll turn it over to you as we start the Q&A section.
Great, thanks, David. We have a few minutes for questions. Luckily, several of the ones that came in, I think we've answered over the course of the discussion, but if we don't get to yours, we'll follow up with you after. The first question is on policy. They are asking if you could comment on policy efforts to require those sorts of data points to be collected. And they're referring to some of the comments you made, Heather, around new hires, rates of promotion, attrition, et cetera, both across gender and ethnicity. Heather, do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about engagement, and I think an important piece of engagement for investors is often public policy engagement. So offering expertise to public policymakers and being supportive of efforts that would advance diversity goals and advance disclosure practices. I think, you know, here in the US, under the Biden-Harris administration, there's certainly more of an appetite to address some of these social challenges. They've launched a gender policy council and a strategy to achieve gender equity and equality, you know, globally. So I think that we're at a place in the US where we could start to see some more types of regulation in this regard. The SEC has put out requirements for companies to discuss human capital in their regulatory filings. That happened over the last year, which was positive. You know, the downside, as we talk about the lack of standardization, is that it was a very principles-based disclosure requirement. And so companies were free to provide information how they wanted. And as a result, it was very difficult to compare information company to company. But I think those are both positive steps forward. And I think it's an area where, again, investors can be working with public policymakers to help craft some of these disclosure practices that would help move the needle.
If I can add to that as an example of another country, in Germany, they passed a law a couple of years ago that if you're in a team of five people or more, as a woman, you can go to HR and ask what your male colleagues in your team earn, what's the average that they earn. And so this is just quick enough that without having to worry about the company publishing anything, as a female employee, you could go to HR and ask for the average salary of your male colleagues if you are in a team of five people or more, and you would get the information. So that's as an example of something that can be put into place, which seems quite simple to then ensure equal pay for equal work.
I think with that, we're probably at the end of our session. I wanted to thank David, Quaylin, Deanna, and Heather. This was such an interesting conversation for us to listen to. I think we could go on much longer, but I really appreciate all of your time and insights. And thank you to the audience for listening. We now have about a 15-minute break. We hope that everybody will join us for the next panel, which is a discussion on implementing a gender lens strategy. So using this data into investment strategies. You'll have to close out of this session to rejoin the next one, and you'll find a link to that next session in your email. So thank you again, and we hope to see everybody in 15 minutes.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.